This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and this week I'm bringing you a conversation that has everything to do with the 2024 election, and we dive deep into issues related to our political system, like the Electoral College, why we have it, and what it actually does. My guest is Paul Savoy. He's co-department head and professor of history, political science, and ethnic studies at Long Beach City College. Paul Savoy has been teaching in the Department of History, Political Science, and Ethnic Studies at Long Beach City College since 1996. During that time, he's taught a wide variety of courses in political science and social science disciplines and has served as a faculty advisor to the Political Science Student Association and other student organizations. He's also served as a coordinator for the Long Beach City College Honors Program and has created and coordinated previously existing programs at Long Beach City College involving elementary school teacher preparation and community-based learning. I loved having this conversation with Paul. I've known him for a long time. We know each other on and off air, and I hope you enjoy this conversation, as always, at least half as much as I did. Paul Savoy, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for passing judgment with us. I'm so excited to talk to you about your thoughts on the election and also your experience teaching college students at Long Beach City College and talking to me about what you hear from them.
I am so excited to be here, Jessica. Thank you so much for inviting me. And yeah, I'm excited to talk about all that stuff as well.
So let's start with the most kind of basic question, I think, which is you are a political scientist, you're the co-department head and a professor of history, political science, and ethnic studies. And I think you look at elections through a different lens than the rest of us do. We're recording this conversation at the end of August, and I'm hoping you could just start with what are some things that you are looking at with respect to this election? Is it where you expected we would be once Kamala Harris took over and became the nominee? Are there some aspects of the race that are really surprising you? Have things gone, you know, about as you thought they would once she became the nominee?
It's interesting because I think that, you know, I don't know that I had any preconceived notions about how things were going to go because, you know, for myself, even as a, well, I guess especially as a political scientist who's been teaching and studying this stuff for just about 30 years now, and yeah, I am that old, but, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, the events of this particular campaign cycle, I mean, just truly unprecedented in so many different levels. And, you know, once President Biden made the decision to no longer seek the Democratic nomination for the presidency, and once, you know, and Kamala Harris came in and all of that, I mean, at this point, it's kind of like, well, you know, so many unprecedented things have happened over the past couple of months in particular that I have no idea how it's going to go, honestly. The one thing that I can tell you, though, and, you know, this comes from, you know, looking very closely at the last couple presidential election cycles, I know that in the end, the results of this election, however they go, it's going to be very, very close. I mean, you know, we have a very roughly divided American electorate. And, you know, with the rise of, you know, partisan and ideological polarization over the past couple of decades in particular, and just because of the way the Electoral College system operates, we shouldn't be surprised if, you know, elections going forward, it's always going to be this question. Well, who's going to win? And are we going to have someone who wins the Electoral College vote, but not the popular vote? And all that sort of thing. So, I mean, the only one certainty, well, I have two certainties. One is that there will be a winner in the next presidential election, and that whoever the winner is, the result is going to be very, very close.
So unsurprisingly, you just touched on my next two questions. I feel like you read my mind here. And one is that I want to talk about the rise of polarization, and the other is the Electoral College. So if we could start in that order, and if you could help educate me as well, because it's something that I hear, I say it, but what do we really mean when we say the rise of polarization? Does it mean we've become more tribal? I'm a Democrat, you're a Republican, and therefore we can never meet in the middle or compromise? Does it mean our positions are more extreme? And so I think first, just a definitional, what exactly do we mean when we keep saying this?
I mean, let's face it, there has always been, and you know, because of the way the authors of our current Constitution, who I like to call the framers, because the framers intentionally rigged our electoral system in the U.S. so we would be, you know, a two-party system, there has always been some degree of division between the two parties. But fortunately, because the framers also designed a system where unless the American public and unless our elected political representatives were able to reach compromise, nothing gets done. Public policy doesn't get made, problems don't get solved, that sort of thing. So they designed the system, and for a very long time, our system worked in such a way where the difference between our two major political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, is kind of like the difference between vanilla ice cream and French vanilla ice cream, meaning not all that much, right? If you mm-hmm. do an actual taste test. And I think that's what the framers wanted. That's what they got for a long time. But then, you know, starting probably about 25 or 30 years ago, we began to see a gradual, you know, growing division amongst the two parties, whether we're talking about amongst our elected representatives in Congress, for example, or just regular folks in society, you know, talking politics. So the division began to slowly increase. And for a number of reasons, the division began to grow and accelerate. And on top of that, besides the actual growth in the polarization between Democrats and Republicans, we also saw an attitudinal change in the sense that it started to become very zero sum, right? That, you know, if I'm a member of one party, I look at the other party, whichever other party that is, and I say, well, you know, not only are these folks incompetent, but guess what? They're dangerous. They hate America. They're trying to destroy this country. And so the level of anger and bitterness between the two sides, you know, has just accelerated dramatically, especially in the last 15 to 20 years. And, you know, some political analysts say that, you know, we have never been this divided amongst liberals and conservatives in the United States, or maybe we haven't been that divided since the U.S. Civil War. And we keep seeing public opinion surveys out there that say that a very significant portion of the American public believes that we could have a second civil war sometime within the next 10 years.
That is remarkable. I mean, to think that we're back here where a significant percentage of the public is saying, yes, we think that could be possible, only because I know you have deep expertise and I just can't help myself. You use the term rigged for a two-party system, and that the framers, those who created our Constitution and therefore our system of government, created this two-party system. And I think for a lot of us, very understandably, it's just not something we spend our daily life thinking about. But this didn't have to be the case, and it's not the case in a lot of other democracies. So could you tell us what you mean by rigged the system so it's a two-party system?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that the framers themselves were scared of political parties because they really didn't know how they were going to go, right? They knew that they couldn't outlaw them, right? They knew that political parties would naturally arise over time, but they were really scared about them kind of spinning out of control. And so one of the reasons why the framers, you know, made a number of adjustments in our constitutional system of government, including the development of the Electoral College, by the way, is they wanted to make sure that we would only have at any one time in our history two major political parties, and that most elected officials would be, if not all of the elected officials, would be from one of those two parties. They really feared what we call a multi-party system, as you see in a number of other European and other democracies around the world. I mean, there are other systems that have maybe three or four or five major political parties that regularly win seats in national elections. And then you have a couple of extreme examples of multi-party systems like Italy and Israel, where you might have 20 or 25 parties who at least are able to elect a few candidates to their national legislature or parliament, or, you know, whatever they want to call it. Now, the framers did not want that. They were afraid that if there were three or five or more political parties that all win some seats in the U.S. Congress, for example, and if no single political party was able to control a majority of seats, say, in the House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate, their fear would be that the U.S. national government would become very, very, very unstable. And we would be in a situation like they are, for example, these days in Italy, where it seems like, you know, they have to have these governing coalitions. No one party can get a majority. The coalitions are very fragile. And it feels like, you know, every 12 to 18 months, voters are going back to the polls because the previous majority coalition has collapsed. They got to try and figure a new one out. So they feared instability in government more than anything else. And that's why they developed, you know, the fancy political science term that we use now is an SMDP system, a single member district plurality system, as opposed to most multi-party systems around the world today that are called proportional representation. And there's many variations in between. You know, for example, the Canadian government, and I actually co-authored a paper with a couple of my professors in grad school several decades ago, we'll say. And we kind of identified the Canadian system as being kind of this weird hybrid. It's really kind of a two-and-a-half party system, if you will. It has mostly elements of an SMDP system, but it acts more sometimes like a proportional system. And a lot of that just has to do with the fact that in Canada, then and now, you have, besides the two major national parties, you have a number of regional political parties that can gain a significant number of seats in parliament. So it's interesting.
I really smiled to myself when you said SMDP, because I love hearing from experts about their area of expertise. And I'm going to ask one more question on this before we get to the Electoral College, which is,
sure,
did it work? So you laid this out very clearly in terms of what the framers were worried about and their fears of instability. But then in our previous conversation a few moments ago, you said some people think there might be a civil war. So has the two-party system worked about as well as it could have, or has there been a fundamental breakdown where maybe we would have been served better by a different system?
I think for the most part, the framers made a rational choice at the time. And, you know, let's face it, you know, I give the authors of our Constitution so much credit for foresight. They made a lot of very prophetic kind of informed guesses mm-hmm. when they were creating the document back in 1787. But obviously, and I tell my students this all the time, you know, they didn't have a clear crystal ball that they could peer into. They could not look to the future and say, oh my God, look what's happening in the U.S. in 2024. And you know, I mean, they probably would have been horrified, you know, on a number of levels, especially folks like Alexander Hamilton. They made a trade-off. The trade-off that they made was they say, we are going to create a system that promotes political and governmental stability over voter choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a fundamental trade-off. And I think that you know, I think that a lot of contemporary voters in the United States, or potential voters, especially a lot of younger potential voters in the United States, they are getting kind of fed up with the lack of choice. Because, you know, prior to President Biden stepping down and being succeeded by Kamala Harris as the Democratic nominee, you know, I had quite a few of my students in my introduction to government, you know, poli sci one classes, saying, you know what, I'm just not going to vote. Because I look at both of my major party choices, and neither of the two grandpas, literally, they said this, you know, do a lot for me for different reasons. And they were asking me about the viability of voting for an independent or third party candidate like RFK Jr. And I had to say, well, you know, again, the framers didn't want you to do that. And so here's a kind of a good segue to where we're going next. So they created this thing called the Electoral College. And if you look at how the Electoral College operates, it pretty much openly discriminates against third party or independent candidates. Even an extremely popular third party candidate, say, for example, you know, a Ross Perot going back several decades. I mean, in the election that, you know, in the first election that Perot ran against, oh gosh, I want to say against George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, Perot received 20% of the popular vote, the people's vote for president nationwide across all 50 states and DC. And 20%, one out of five popular votes for an independent or third party presidential candidate, that's astounding. But how many actual electoral votes did that result in? Well, zero, because the Electoral College discriminates against minor or third party candidates intentionally.
And against large states, it seems to me. So yeah. This is the perfect place where I think we should pause for a minute and just remind everybody, and I'm going to ask you to do this because this is your area. What is the Electoral College? And I was speaking to some very young, younger than your students, people recently, and I realized, quite understandably, that when I was continuing to talk about which states and swing voters, that it wasn't computing, again, for completely rational reasons, because in their world, if you get the most votes, then you win the election. But that's, of course, not the system we live under.
Right. So basically, the Electoral College emerged because of one of the many disputes that raged amongst the framers back in Philadelphia in 1787. While the framers knew they had to create some degree of democracy, there has to be some extent to which, you know, voters have real influence over what elected officials do and how they do it. A lot of the framers, a lot of folks at the Philadelphia Convention just didn't trust voters all that much. Because, you know, we have to remember that the framers, for the most part, were under the sway of various classical liberal philosophers like Thomas Hobbes and John Locke and Edmund Burke and people like that. And one of the really interesting things about the classical liberal philosophers, and when I teach Introduction to Western Political Thought, you know, we always talk about this, and my students always kind of marvel at it, because classical liberals had this very negative and almost depressed view of human nature. They tended to think that most people, even elites in society, which is kind of interesting, that most people aren't very intelligent. They're overly emotional. They're often selfish and narcissistic and that sort of thing. And that they often make really rash, poorly informed choices, right? And so the framers, for the most part, were these orthodox classical liberals. And so they had this real dilemma on their hands, because on the one hand, the voters, the people, need to have some control over, you know, who serves in government and what those public officials do and all that sort of thing. But they didn't want to give them too much power over who holds power within the government, you know, for fear that, you know, they would say, for example, electing members of Congress, that they would, a lot of them would make bad choices, rash decisions, and they'd end up electing idiots and con men into Congress. And I always tell my students, you know, can you, and I look very seriously at them, I say, can you imagine idiots and con men in Congress? Whoever heard of such a thing? And that usually gets a fairly big laugh, which is helpful. And so that's why, for example, that if you look at the design of Congress, originally the design of Congress for the new Constitution was going to carry over from what it was under our first Constitution, the disastrous Articles of Confederation. But instead, they created that bicameral two-chamber Congress so that then and now, voters directly elect members of the House of Representatives, the lower house of Congress. But originally, voters did not directly select the members of the U.S. Senate. Instead, those choices were made by each state government's legislature. They chose senators. And they thought that, okay, so if the voters choose one house of Congress, and the state governments, the experienced state legislators, choose the upper house of Congress, and you have to have both in sync in order to get anything done, that could, you know, hopefully significantly reduce the likelihood of extreme bad actions by members of Congress in creating legislation or doing what else. So, like I always tell the students, whether we're talking about Congress or in presidential elections, the development of the Electoral College, the framers wanted to give the voters some power, but not too much power, right? And this carries through to the Electoral College as well, because the Electoral College itself has undergone significant evolution since the framers originally stuck it into the Constitution in 1787. Originally, members of the Electoral College, they are still selected by ordinary voters, as they are now. But originally, the members of the Electoral College were supposed to be these, you know, experienced, well-respected members of the local community who basically the framers felt that they could trust more than the rash decisions of the average voter. And so originally, under the Electoral College, the members of the Electoral College got to make up their own mind as to who they were going to vote for president and vice president. And that didn't last very long. Various states over time began evolving how their Electoral College system works to where it is today, where Electoral College members are not supposed to make up their own minds. Instead, they are supposed to vote for whichever presidential candidate wins the popular vote, that is the people's vote, in their state on election day.
How does this affect our current race? So in the sense of, I think for people who have just read the headlines, there's a feeling that Harris has to win way more votes than Trump in order to win the Electoral College. And we, of course, know that winning the national popular vote is a nice pat on the back, but it didn't give much solace to Hillary Clinton or her supporters when Donald Trump was being sworn in.
Yeah, exactly.
How does the Electoral College, and I know you talked about this and you laid it out in a way that just made me so happy to hear about what is this really about? Why did we put it into place and how has it changed? And now let's talk about the consequence, the impact, which is, what does it tend to favor Republicans? Does it tend to favor small states? And that at this point translates into favoring Republicans. What's happening right now?
Well, it depends. And remember, you know, the Electoral College itself is only one of several factors, including the polarization that we already spoke of, to help us understand why presidential elections in general, especially starting in, well, really starting in 2000, but really becoming a thing in 2016, where they're just going to become routinely, you know, with, you know, razor thin margins in terms of the Electoral College and more presidents being elected by the Electoral College but not winning the national popular vote, which, as you said, has no value. I mean, you know, be a popular vote winner nationally, and I'll give you $6 and maybe you can buy a cup of coffee at Starbucks, basically. It's kind of how that works. So there's a number of factors at play. But here's the thing. Traditionally, the way that a particular presidential candidate from either party, you know, how they look at how do we design our campaign? What do we do and how do we do it to get to, you know, the minimum number of electoral college votes that we need to be able to actually win the election? You know, there have traditionally been a number of different paths to the White House, depending upon who you are as a candidate, what your home state is, what the home state of your vice presidential nominee is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think what complicates things now is that you have a number of these swing states, right? Mm-hmm. A number of states that are just the difference between the Republican vote and the Democratic vote. Well, really, the vote generally is very closely divided between the two major party candidates. And some folks also like to talk about the fact that we have red states, meaning, you know, heavily conservative states. We have blue states, much more liberal states, but that we also have purple states too, that are kind of a more delicate mix of red and blue. And, you know, if you look at a state like Arizona, or you look at a number of other states that are called swing states today, those really do tend to be the more purple states. And honestly, I think a lot of the traditional rules of campaigning in a presidential election have been turned upside down over the last few election cycles anyway. And, you know, I really would be interested in hearing a tell-all eventually, if there is one, by, you know, campaign insiders in the Harris-Walz campaign to find out kind of what was their thinking as they were going into this. According to most folks who study this stuff, a lot of the experts and the pundits that I've seen, you know, to this point, the Harris-Walz campaign has really kind of played things, you know, pretty much pitch perfect. And they seem to have, you know, a plan that will help them kind of flip the script a little bit in a number of these swing states. And we're starting to see early polling in these swing states to indicate that this is happening to, in some cases, a fairly significant extent. But, you know, it isn't over till it's over, right? And, you know, one thing that I've learned, especially with the 2016 presidential election, in these very close races where a number of swing states are at stake, you can only put so much trust into the polls because, you know, again, polls are a snapshot in time. And especially if you have at least one very controversial candidate in the race, voters have a tendency to lie to pollsters. Say, well, you know, if the election were to be held today, who would you vote for? And you'd say, and the person says, well, you know, gosh, I really would vote for candidate X, but the person asking me the questions might look down on me if I say that I'm voting for candidate X. So I'm going to vote for I'll tell them I'm voting for candidate Y instead. And then when I actually go and vote, and it's my private decision, I'm going to vote for candidate X. German political scientists had a great term for this event, this practice. They call it a spiral of silence effect, which I think is just, isn't that? Oh, I know. I think that is my favorite term in political science, the spiral of silence effect. It sounds so mysterious and dramatic at the same time, but yet the result, I mean, it makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when you look at the difference between one candidate and the other in either a national poll or a state-by-state poll, what do you see? In the last several elections, the differences between the two candidates is often in the margin of error for the poll. So that's why I keep going back to the thing that I said originally, that whoever wins, the result is going to be extremely extremely close, because polling only tells us so much about what voters are actually going to do when they cast their ballot.
Well, and this brings me to another topic, which is you spend a lot of your work life talking to young people, where this is probably their first presidential election. And do any of them respond to polls? I mean, it seems to me that polling is unreliable. And again, I'm not an expert on polling for a couple of reasons. One is I love the phenomenon that you just explained in terms of why you wouldn't want to answer honestly. But another is, I think we're still predominantly using landlines and talking to people who will pick up a landline and respond to those questions. And so it seems to me to skew towards a demographic that may not be representative of the electorate. Are there other issues with respect to polling that you think we should keep our eyes on?
Well, you know, I mean, and I will tell you that, you know, as we've made the transition from, you know, landline phones to actual cell phones, I know that polling organizations have become more sophisticated in their designs, and they are much better able to accommodate, you know, the movement from landlines to cell phones. And so I think that polls conducted today with the more recent methodology, you know, they are considerably more accurate and perhaps a bit more sophisticated than they were, say, 20, 30, 50 years ago, whatever. But all that being said, there is still so much that can go wrong with even a well-designed mm-hmm. public opinion survey. And so you always have to pay attention to the stated margin of error in the poll. And, you know, if you see a survey with what people tend to feel is an excessively high margin of error, that just means that there's more noise in the data. And that makes the process of predicting based on that data, you know, a lot more challenging, a lot more problematic. I mean, there's so many things that can go wrong. You know, for example, if a poll worker, you know, someone who a pollster's representative, somebody who's actually calling folks on the phone and asking them the questions and, you know, recording their responses, if that person, normally those folks are very underpaid, they work in large telephone boiler rooms, it's really not a very pleasant job. From everything that I've seen and everything that I've been told, if they're not being very careful as they're asking the questions mm-hmm. and they're not asking the questions in a fairly objective or neutral way, you know, people responding to these polls, they're always listening. They're listening very carefully. Mm-hmm. It's like, can I hear anything in how that question is being asked that might indicate that the person giving me the poll, that they prefer one answer over the others? Yeah. And if you're not careful, because, you know, I mean, most polls, unless it's a push poll, that's something different entirely. But most polls, they're trying to get people's, you know, honest response. But if someone reads too much into the tone of voice, the pitch, the intonation of how the question is asked of them over the phone, they might be influenced and they might not give their honest response. And the more times that happens, the more sort of wrong responses are being given or non-honest responses are being given. That just adds noise to the data, raises up the margin of error. So for me, if you ever see a poll where the margin of error is plus or minus 4 percentage points or above, I would be very skeptical about that poll, because that's a lot, that reflects a lot of noise in the data.
That's really helpful to think about. And I mean, there's so much, we can't even kid to this today, but there's so much information, disinformation and misinformation that we have to sort through. Mm-hmm. And now you're helping us mm-hmm. think through which polls are the polls that we can trust, which is obviously a big deal. In this conversation, I'm absolutely convinced that we should make this a part one if you have time. So I'm going to conclude.
Oh, I would love that.
Thank you, because I know you're very busy. And this is a busy time for political scientists. So I would love to ask two very different questions to end. And the first one is, in looking at the structure of our Constitution and the structure of how we run elections, and when you talk to your students about how our system functions, and I'm purposely being really general here, are there one or two things where you think, gosh, I wish we just didn't have X, because I think we'd have a better system? Maybe it's the Electoral College. Maybe it's the two-party system. Maybe actually, if you compare what's happening in the U.S. to other countries, nothing falls within this bucket. But I'm just so curious as a scholar and a teacher, are there a few things where you look and think, oh, if we could just change that?
You know, it's interesting. You know, I have these musings from time to time, but I don't tend to think about this a lot. And here's why. Because, you know, certainly, could the Electoral College be reformed? Could it possibly be eliminated and just go with a straight national popular vote? I mean, you could argue, and there have been tons of books written by political scientists and others, you know, about this. There's lots of changes that we could make. But the thing is, if for most of those changes to take place, you would have to go in and formally amend the U.S. Constitution. And as I also tell my students, the framers intentionally made it extremely difficult to formally change the document, right? Because the framers, as I said earlier, the framers were these really big followers of classical liberals. And they really bought into Thomas Hobbes's notion of trying to create what he called an eternal constitution. That is a constitution that could last for hundreds of years without significant changes, you know, built into it. And part of why the framers were really into this idea of an eternal constitution is that they were just coming off, because most of the folks in Philadelphia in 1787 who wrote our current constitution, with a few exceptions, also wrote our short-lived, disastrous first constitution in 1776, the Articles of Confederation. And the Articles of Confederation, there they made some fundamental mistakes that blew up in their faces. And, you know, by 1787, here they are back in Philadelphia trying to create a brand new constitution. They said, look, this is crazy. We can't keep doing this every 15 or 20 years. We got to create a system that lasts. And so they made the Constitution, our current Constitution, extremely hard to revise because they kind of looked at the results of their work in Philadelphia. They looked at the actual original draft of the Constitution itself. And they said, look, you know, we have very carefully created this rather complex system. And they looked at their work in the Constitution and creating the governmental structure of the United States as being like a very finely handcrafted mechanical watch or a grandfather clock or something like that, which has, you know, all of these very, you know, complex and intricate gears and flywheels and all this stuff. And they're all positioned in extremely precise way. And as long as nothing falls out of balance in the mechanism, it continues to work flawlessly, right? And so their fear was, look, if we make it too easy to formally amend the Constitution and suddenly, you know, instead of 27 amendments today, now we say we had 100 or 150 or, you know, something like that, that there would be so many changes made in the internal construction of the Constitution that various parts would fall out of balance and the system would freeze up and stop working. So, you know, we can talk about a lot of this stuff and there's little things that we could do. I mean, I think, you know, one common sense electoral college reform that we could do, and we could probably do it, we could definitely do it, I think, without, you know, amending the Constitution, would be to have all states do what Maine and Nebraska do. That instead of saying, well, okay, candidate X got, you know, more of the popular vote than the other candidate, therefore they get all of the state's electoral votes, instead of having the Electoral College vote in each state be winner take all, do what Maine and Nebraska does, make it proportional. So that if a candidate gets 55% of the popular vote in that state, they get 55% of the Electoral College votes or you know, however you can make that work. So, I mean, there's some common sense things that we could do, but really major structural changes that would require a formal amendment, not really going to happen. So I don't tend to think about that much.
Well, that is very fair, and that is based in reality. And so for my closing question for you, I want to ask another question based in reality, which is, what are your students talking to you about? What are the issues that are most pressing to them? Is it the economy in general? Is it reproductive choice? Is it more specific about student loans or medical care? What, or is it more about personality or kind of generally who's a Democrat, who's a Republican? But what do you hear from them in terms of their thinking about this election?
Well, I mean, there's lots of things. And obviously they're thinking, I was happy that you know, we had the first week of the new semester so I could kind of get an update, because we've had so much happen and change in the election in just the past several weeks. But I think throughout the entire election campaign cycle that we've seen so far, and really even prior to it, from you know, when the U.S. Supreme Court dropped the Dobbs decision, the number one issue that I continue to hear about is the larger issue of reproductive rights and reproductive health and that sort of thing, and trying to turn back the clock. Because my students were just blown away when I said, now you realize when the Dobbs decision dropped, I said, you realize this is the first time that the U.S. Supreme Court has taken a fundamental right, a fundamental freedom away from the American people.
I think that it's both obviously a huge legal change and a legal decision with huge consequences. So it is fascinating to me how much this decision has, I think, changed virtually every election, even elections where people frankly don't have a lot of control over how easy or difficult it will be to obtain access to abortions. This is an issue where the Supreme Court makes some decisions that affect how we vote, for instance, the Voting Rights Act and campaign finance, and then they make decisions that become issues in the campaign, that become really important talking points. And it's a good, a good reminder, again, that the decision is more than 2 years old and it's still at the top of people's minds.
Exactly. And so a lot of students are still talking about that. Another issue that was big prior to the shift from Biden to Kamala Harris, though, was on the issue of the Palestinian people and U.S. policy regarding the Israel-Hamas war. And a lot of folk, a lot of my students, especially the younger ones, were saying, you know, look, they were really acting as single issue voters. And they're saying, well, I don't like the Biden policy on all of this, and so I'm just not going to vote, or I'm not going to vote for Biden. And they were asking me, well, you know, what does Trump think about this? And what does RFK Jr. think about this? And we had some rather interesting discussions about that. And we talked about, you know, the efficacy of being a single issue voter and how that could have potentially unanticipated consequences, you know, if a lot of people did that. But obviously, since Biden stepped out and Vice President Harris stepped in, I'm not really hearing much talk of that anymore. I think a lot of students are waiting to kind of hear more constructively about what she's saying. And I'm actually having some people now, some students now, asking me questions about Project 2025, wanting to know more about that and some of the details in that, because, you know, of saying, well, you know, if you thought the Dobbs decision was harsh and extreme, just look at some of the other stuff that is being talked about. So those would be the things that are on students' mind. One quick thing I should say, though, my students, California Community College students in general, aren't as uniformly as young as you would think, or as they perhaps used to be.
That's a good reminder.
I heard a rather interesting statistic from our vice president for academic affairs just last week, as we were gearing up for the start of the new semester. Approximately 60% of students at Long Beach City College are what we call indirect matriculants, meaning that they did not move directly from high school into college. Mm-hmm. They took, in some cases, a few years off, in many cases, a lot of years off, and maybe they tried the working world and, you know, kind of got knocked around a little bit, and now they're coming back. So I have a really wide age range in my classes. It's not just the, you know, stereotypical 18-year-old from Lakewood that are in my classes, which is interesting.
It is. And there's no surprise because you're their professor. It sounds like they're asking really informed and thoughtful questions. And Paul Savoy, I want to thank you so much. I learned a lot from this conversation. And there are so many places where we could have just kept talking. So I hope you'll come back and we'll continue the conversation.
It would be my great pleasure. Anytime.